And I remember just stopping for a moment backstage in between, you know, flinging all of these costumes, just letting it all hang there for a moment and thinking, I've arrived.
Hello, my name's Kay Anderson, and you are listening to Lost Spaces, the podcast that mourns the death of queer nightlife. So every week I talk to a different person about a venue from their past, the memories that they created there, and the people that they used to know. So when I'm talking about lost spaces and when I talk about the importance of these queer spaces to our identity as a community, I'm mostly thinking about them as places where people go to find others and connect and explore their identity in a safe space, for want of a better term. You know, I keep talking about how important it is that we had these spaces to practice being ourselves when there was nothing else for us. But there's this whole other layer that I don't really ever think about all that much, and I was reminded of it in this week's conversation. And that is that for performers, these spaces are, on top of everything else that I've just mentioned, where they get to dream and craft and create and fuck up in front of a safe and understanding audience. And that's huge. That's so monumental. So anyway, the reason I was reminded of this is because of this week's chat. This week I'm joined by the cabaret geek himself, Paulus, who took a break from his latest show, Looking For Me Friend, which is a show that celebrates the music of Victoria Wood, to talk about Madame Jojo's, which was in London, in England, if you don't know where London is. It was here that he got his big break as a drag queen. And though drag is no longer his bread and butter, the place remains important to him because of the magic within the walls. And I know that sounds cheesy, I know it sounds stupid, but it's true. There was magic within those walls. We talk all about the thanklessness of drag, building yourself a chosen family, and how sometimes really all you need is a wonderful middle-aged woman to tell you what you should do next with your life. Why don't we get into it? So how did you come to be in London?
Oh, I came here to go to drama school. I moved from a little village in Kent, where the, you know, the Canterbury Tales and Chaucer wrote his stories, and Thomas à Becket was killed. I grew up just outside Canterbury. And yes, I came to London, where the streets are paved with chicken bones, it turns out, once you get here.
And every top deck of every bus has about 15 chicken bones, yeah. So what was the plan then? Was it to come to London, conquer London, then conquer the world, or something else?
I came to go to drama school. So I would have been 94. It was quite short notice, actually, because I'd split up with a boyfriend and moved back in with my mum. And what was supposed to be a summer job in Canterbury Cathedral had turned into a full-time job. And I rather enjoyed working in this gift shop, selling tea towels and jam and catalogues about the history of Canterbury with all these middle-aged women. I love middle-aged women, I always have. And actually, now I'm middle-aged, I love older women. So they had to basically tell me to leave, these fabulous women that I hung out with, and one particular woman, Mia, she said to me, "You're moving to London and going to drama school soon." I said, "Am I?" She said, "Yes, you are. You're 17 and we're all over 40. Get out of here." So I applied to some drama schools, and it was kind of a dumb time of year to apply in that it was very short notice. I thought I was applying for the year after, but I got accepted in a school for what was like 2 or 3 months away. So then it was all systems go in panic stations.
Ah, nothing like a bit of pressure to get you going.
Yeah, a deadline is what we all need.
So then by the sounds of it, you were quite happy just like living it up in Canterbury. You hadn't always planned to move to London, or you had, but you got waylaid because you loved the women over 40.
I was really dumb. People kept having to tell me really obvious things like, you're gay and you're going to go to drama school and you're an entertainer. I didn't know any of those things, and I didn't have a family. You know, I didn't have a stage mother. I didn't have a pushy stage mother. I had a supportive mother who was like, if you want to do something, you've got to stick at it. So you want to go to dance class, you go for the whole term, you don't miss a single class. That was my mother's way. And I did that with dance and drama and stuff, and it instilled a great, you know, work ethic in me when I was still quite a young teenager. But she wasn't like, right, off to do your headshots, find us an agent. You know, if I wanted to do these things, I would always have been supported. So I just, I suppose, I didn't really think of it as a viable option, really.
It was really interesting to hear you talk about it like that, because most people who are interested in the performing arts, or, well, any kind of art at all, I have to come up against everyone saying, are you sure you want to do that? It's not really a good career option. But it sounds like everyone around you was telling you that that's what you must be doing.
Yeah, I have other friends who were around the same age, who are still in the business now. And one guy I'm thinking of in particular, and his mum was so, you know, like, you have to have something to fall back on. You can do all of these things you're planning to do, but first you're going to hairdressing college. And that was like, there's no choice in the matter. And I think with me, everybody just realised I couldn't do anything else.
You could sell tea towels.
And I do, by the bucket load. We'll get to that later, Kay. That's the irony of the story. I make homemade jam, I sell tea towels, and I still hang out with a lot of middle-aged women. It's just now I do a show for them first.
So at first I was thinking this was a good thing, but so what everyone was like, you're hopeless at everything else. You have to do this.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe it was just sort of like really obvious to everybody else. And because I'd split up with this guy and I was floundering a bit, I was already sort of terrible with money and had sort of got myself into some debt and only been living away from home for 6 months. So how I managed that, I don't know. You know, I hadn't even got to London yet and I was in debt. So, yeah, I mean, I'm grateful to them. I'm really grateful to Mia and all the other girls for giving me the push that they did. I just, sometimes I need slapping around the face and telling what to do next. Which is frowned upon in this day and age, but I've always admired it in people.
So London then. So you're 17-ish, you're coming to drama school. What are your first memories of being in London?
Oh, well, other than chicken bones all over the pavements, dirt, if I'm completely honest with you, filth. Looking at single room bedsits on really busy main roads, you know, and you're on the ground floor at the front of the house, and anyone, and they did, you know, just come in and pee in your garden or knock on your window at 4 a.m. I mean, terrifying places to live. And my mother traipsed around with me for 2 days in North London in these places we'd never heard of. You know, she spent my childhood taking me up to London to go to Hamleys and see the Christmas lights at Harrods and, yeah, lovely theatre trips and get me cultured. And then when you move to London, you go to Wood Green and Turnpike Lane and Manor House because that's where you can afford to live. And unfortunately, they don't look very much like West, any part of Kensington or the West End. So I remember that, and I remember ultimately getting a bedsit with a really, really super household, but a completely bonkers household of people, which was part drama students like me, and then the landlady and her husband, and then there was a small baby, and there was a cat without a tail that used to chase the tail that wasn't there. That was terrifying. And then a man called Nibil, but we called him Nibble, and he barely ever came out of his room, Nibil, and he never spoke to any of us. You heard his door open and close in the dead of night, but that was it. You never saw Nibil. And just years of having to initial the larger grains in my coffee granules to stop them from being nicked by everybody else that lived there. Just lots of stealing and no one else cleaning the toilet but me. That's what I can remember from the first few years.
Well, that happens in any share house.
Yeah.
What about London? What was it about London that caught you?
Well, I guess it was the go-to for the vast majority of drama schools in the 90s, and a lot of the UK was still, you know, not as well connected as it is now, travel-wise. I didn't drive. I still don't drive, actually. So it seemed the obvious and yet clichéd go to London to seek your fortune. And because Kent is only 60 miles away from London for me, then, you know, I could have gone to Manchester, I could have gone to Wales, I could have gone to Scotland, but none of them would have been as easy to get back home to in the short term.
And sorry, I'm talking about it as though, like, of course you'd love London, of course you'd want to be here. What are you, like, why wouldn't you fall under its charms immediately?
But yeah, you assume that once you leave drama school, and my drama school had a nickname. Do I want to say where I went to drama? No, I don't really want to. Anyway, my drama school was very intrinsically linked with the productions of Les Miserables and Miss Saigon, and even had a nickname which suggested that as soon as you graduate, you go straight into Les Mis, basically. And so there were, I loved musicals already. And as I said, I was so fortunate to be taken up to London quite a lot, and we would always see a musical. From I was the age of about 11, I think I got to see at least one huge West End show once a year, and from the very first one I saw, I fell in love with that. So I guess that's what I thought would happen. I would go to drama school, and then as soon as I left drama school, I'd go into one of those shows, and I'd be tap dancing on a great big coin like the women in 42nd Street Band.
And the way you're talking about it makes me think that that didn't happen.
Oh, you're very perceptive. No, that didn't happen quite. I have been in musicals, but I've never taken the right or the direct path to anything. And I went down, post-drama school, I went down a slip road of cabaret very, very, very fast, which is why I'm now known as the cabaret geek.
And what were your first impressions of the scene in London?
Well, everything had blacked out windows in the 90s, every gay venue. So the only other places that I knew of that had blacked out windows or no windows were betting shops, I guess, and sex shops. So when it came to going out and going anywhere gay or queer, my immediate sense was of an illicitness, an underground, a forbidden, or perhaps unhealthy because of the other spaces that shared that sort of shopfront, as it were, or a lack of shopfront. It was a lot of, you've got to knock on the door three times and then ask for Mike, you know, and all of that bollocks to be let in. So you had to be quite bold, even though I'd been brought up to, you know, walk into the Royal Academy and know that I have a right to be there to look at the pictures. I'm not so good at walking up to a blackened out door and knocking on it and waiting for a terrifyingly enormous, a taciturn person to decide whether or not I'm allowed in. So I was really timid. I was very, very scared. I probably wallflowered for the most part. And then when I don't wallflower, I go completely the other way and I'm utterly outrageous and ridiculous, you see. I don't know how to do anything in between.
Why do you think that is?
I think people that know me would probably find it amusing to hear me say that I'm an introvert of any kind. Or maybe people that have seen me perform and don't know me, more to the point. But I actually think that I cope with life by being on, by performing.
Ah.
I have a girlfriend who I've known since those drama school years, and only in the last decade did we both share with each other, sometimes I can't come out. I can't come out and see you. I've known you lot for nearly 30 years. I love you. I trust you. I know you're my people, but I can't be on today, so I can't leave the house. It's taken us to our 40s to realise these people love you. You haven't got to be on. You haven't got to do any kind of act. All you got to do is show up and be honest, you know. But that's not how I do things. Like yesterday I did a show and I have to decompress from the world. and I'm really happy to have spent the whole day alone, apart from preparing to talk to you in my garden with my cat. And that's the balance I have to strike. Otherwise, I'd be going postal on a weekly basis on people's asses.
How long did it take you to realise that you needed to give yourself that time? Or not realise, but be comfortable with setting your boundaries?
Oh, God, these realisations for me and actually putting them into practice, I'm talking about the last 3 or 4 years. I'm talking about...
Ah, okay.
Yeah, this is really new. I mean, it's one thing, isn't it, I think, to say something out loud, to acknowledge it. It's a whole other ballgame to actually start changing the script in your head about who you are, what you do, and just pattern, just habit. We all know that everybody wants you to do a 30-day challenge to take up yoga because we know it takes 30 days at least to form any kind of habit. So I think these changes have taken me a very, very long time to put into practice. And I've now found a way of being an entertainer and doing live performance, making enough money to be comfortable, and yet also being able to regularly retreat and go, no, I'm not going out today. I can't do 8 shows a week. I can't be in a musical. It's not possible for me.
I think, like, for myself, I am not good at saying no. So, like, if I have 10 social appointments in a week, I mean, that never happens because no one wants to see me. But, like, let's say I have 10 in a week. I wouldn't be very good at saying no. So I would just be like, I need to go. And like, I just need to keep this energy up and just keep going. And then kind of not recognize how exhausted I was until I would then spend 2 weeks not seeing anyone to catch up.
Wow. Yeah, I absolutely. And sometimes I look in my diary and, you know, my husband sometimes says, he's flying to Milan in about an hour. He's going straight from work. And he said to me, do I want to come to Milan? Now, what's not to like about that idea? Go to Milan with your husband for the weekend, right? And I'm like, just a few days after I've got back from Paris, I don't think I can. And he knows. He knows me well enough. He understands that I can't, I can't do it because it will be... I don't really like flying. I don't like travel in general. But yeah. So now I just have to meter things out and be like, this is what I know I can give.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's really hard to know what you know you can give.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I listened to this amazing interview with a monk, a Buddhist monk, and the interviewer was talking to him about how much we give out. And the interviewer says to him, this is a couple of years ago, the interviewer says to him, so I've read that you recommend that output-wise, we shouldn't be doing more than 70%. And the Buddhist monk says, yeah, well, right now for some people, I would lower that even lower. I would, you know, take yourself down to 40% or 50%. This is, you know, just post-pandemic. And his point, which I love and admire so much, is if you're always putting out 100%, there's no percent left for you to take in what's happening, you know? Like, if I kept talking for the entire however long it is that we're together, you'll never get to say anything. And I certainly wouldn't have been listening to you. I couldn't have done, could I? Because I've been talking. It's to learn how much to give to people. When you're gregarious on stage, and my stage is the cabaret stage, and there isn't a fourth wall between the audience and the performer, you know, we acknowledge that you're there, and we want you to acknowledge that we're there. We don't want you to talk all the way through it, but we do want to have a dialogue in inverted commas with you.
Laugh in the appropriate spots.
Right, yeah, I am totally in control, but you will have a good time. So yeah, I think that sort of overbearing, you know, the ringmaster MC gregarious monster that I've created in different ways on stage over the years, that is how I would have been at someone else's party or hosting my own party or doing the shopping. I've got two dials, you know. I've got haven't washed, don't look at me, trundling along, glaring at everyone, or ta-da, on. So that, for me, that translates in relationships, that translates into I love you or I hate you. And that's a massively unhealthy way to be about human beings. Cause...
But people know where they stand. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, right. It's that I'm very black and white, for sure. Yeah, but it would be nice to find some grey.
And so have you thought about how to get that grey then, how to blend those two sides of yourself more, or are you just happy for them to be distinct?
You were talking about saying no or not saying no to people. I do say yes to people almost as a knee-jerk reaction. I was doing a show in Paris last week with some Americans, and one of the organizers, she came into the dressing room and she said, she's a sly one, this one, I've met her before, and she says to me, somebody in the at the venue's got a professional video camera, and they're going to film us perform tonight. I said, great, oh, fantastic, that's wonderful, what, great. You know, I was just there with, yes, yes, ba, 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 ba. And of course, the next sentence is, so it will be £25 each. What? Oh, I already said yes before I even got the data. Oh dear, okay. And it turns out that, you know, my makeup ran so badly that there's no chance I'd be able to use that recording. So I did find a get out in the end. We're like, look, I'm really sorry, but that would be unusable for me. And also I got a word wrong and I don't want to see that performance. But actually, if I just waited and said, aha, and let her say more, knowing her like I do, of course that was going to be the next sentence. So I think shutting up and listening and not going to yes or no, which is black and white, isn't it? Or even just how much I smile at people. Because just because you're not smiling at somebody doesn't mean you have to glower at them. There is something, well, lots of places in between the two, actually. There's lots.
Well, I don't know if you've got a resting bitch face. Sometimes you just can't control it.
That's true too.
But it's interesting to, you know, the way I've interpreted what you've said, and when you're talking about those two sides of yourself, is that quiet, introverted side of you doesn't get seen by people. If people are going to see you, they're going to see that extroverted, loud person.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I have, of course, done online things, and actually I did a project that happened to cover some of the lockdowns during the pandemic, because I decided to do a YouTube challenge and like film myself daily for an entire year. Now I failed massively at that challenge, and I stopped after 250 days.
That's not failing massively.
Well, it is to me. Okay. One video was 20 seconds long, and I was entirely under the duvet except for one eye. That was all I could give. That was all I could give. 20 seconds and one eye. And when that day happened on the challenge, I was like, can't do this. And actually the pandemic, you know, I would never have set out to do a challenge like that if I'd known what was about to happen to myself and the world. So, you know, there is good reason for having shifted those parameters. But yeah, I try and be natural. I try and, you know, I invite people into my garden. People see my roses and my cat, and they see photos of my husband, and I call him the lesser spotted husband. And a lot of people don't know his name. And people come up to me at gigs now and say, how's the lesser spotted husband? And I'm like, what are you talking? Oh, yes, of course. I say that all the time. I forget anyone's watching. So I don't really know. You'd have to ask the people that follow me on social media. I'm trying to be honest. But as I say that, I know that I adopt voices that aren't mine. I've been doing it in this conversation. I've been dropping the G's at the end of my words. And actually, that's not me. That's the woman who I celebrate on stage. That's her voice. I had to stop myself in therapy a few months ago. I went, hang on a minute. No, that's not my voice. That's Victoria Wood.
Interesting.
Some people think it's their mother's voice, you know. I'm just a dead comedian's.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how much we all perform for the world. Like, you know, we're all putting on something to either entice or repel people. And so it's sometimes just hard to know where the real you ends and where the phony, fake persona that you're putting on starts, or whether that is all just you. So just accept it. I don't know where I'm going with this, sorry. I'm just kind of...
No, I appreciate what you just said, actually, and it's helpful because I think, to be completely honest, it's of course this is all armor. We're talking about armor, and I hope that over, you know, if one is privileged enough to live a long life, that you learn how to take some of it off when you go out in public.
Or you learn how to shine it properly.
Yeah, it's very good. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But it would be nice to know that it's possible to take it off. I think that's what matters the most, is that you can, and you have the agency to, and you haven't become that metal armour. But, you know, when does a prop become a prop? Is something I often ask my students when I'm running workshops. So there's a reason why I've never been, touch wood, I've never been, I was physically assaulted once in London. But I think I've been very fortunate to have lived in London this long and had no significant physical attacks. And losing your hair at 23 helps, and scowling your way through life helps as well. But I found a way of being, and when I open my mouth, all the game changes, because go, a great big Mary. But if I don't open my mouth and I'm not moving, I'm just still and bald, then that can be quite terrifying. I want to know that that's a choice still, and that I haven't become.
Yeah.
What did parents used to say to you when you were little? If you keep doing that face and the wind changes, you'll stay like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the thing that always happens to me is that and maybe this is common for everyone, so I don't know why I'm making it about me. Well, it's my show, I'll make it about me.
Yeah, because the micro is in the macro. That's why you should talk about yourself.
Ooh. I get to a point with new people where I'm like a month in or something, and they've seen all my charming sides, and then I'm like, oh, how do I transition to being like the grumpy, horrible person that I am and not lose them? Like, how do you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't know, because I spend such a fleeting amount of time with my customers, with my audiences, you know, and because I work either solo or with just a piano player, I don't have to, you know, I'm not part of a cast. I'm not part of a group of people or an alternative family. I do have an alternative family to my biological family, but they're not work-based. They're not based around theatre. And just tangenting here, I'm actually having a tremendous problem with the use of the word family when it comes to work organisations, you know, using it. We're a family. No, we're not. I would not be here if you weren't paying me. You know, that is literally the opposite of...
Well, it does happen with a lot of families, you know, like, I'm just hanging around so I can get the inheritance.
Yes, true enough. And if I was fortunate enough to be from a family like that, maybe I would, but we've never had anything, so there wasn't anything to hang around for.
Yeah, it is a weird hijacking of language, isn't it?
I find it tremendously insulting. And of course, to throw that back in the face of somebody that you work with or for, that's never going to fall well, you know, to find me the good ears that falls on. You know, you just come across as an arsehole, basically. But they're the arsehole for actually trying to impose such a ridiculous thing to say. It's a ridiculous, it's gaslighting.
I mean, but I also feel slightly uncomfortable about the term when talking about like chosen family or people that, you know, are not your biological family, but are your chosen family. I've just explained that again. It kind of creates these dynamics where, like, I can be as shit as I want to you. I can be a horrible person to you, but we're a chosen family, so you're just going to have to put up with it. Maybe I've just seen the bad side of it.
Well, maybe you just chose a really crap family. I agree. Yeah, I agree with what I agree. I know what you mean, but I guess my London family, kisses to you all, especially the ones that aren't in London anymore, but you're still London family to me and to the others, I'm sure. I think it's because because coming to London is terrifying and tremendously lonely and very, very tough. But also, you know, there's a lot of stuff when you come to drama school that gets unpacked whether you want it to or not. And that does delve into your childhood and how you feel about your mum and stuff like that. And so we had an opportunity to go, well, look, we're all together now and we won't do that to you. And we will say these words that you didn't hear. And I suppose you build a new framework. And yes, over time, that becomes hard too. And they let you down too. And you have fights with them too. I've definitely had moments where I'm like, oh, am I about to fall out with my London family? And my biological family. Am I going to lose everyone? And that's when you really have to look in the mirror, you know.
But I bet you that's satisfying to the binary part of you. That's like all or nothing, right?
Yes, but that's the saboteur in me. That's the worst in me, I think.
I'm a bit like that. But I don't know if it's the worst. I think sometimes it's like the thing you need and the saboteur is the one that's just brave enough to do it.
Yeah, that is also true. There is an honesty that comes along with that that maybe people admire. I guess I just go away thinking, oh, that was harsh. Oh, that was...
I fucked everything up, yeah.
I'm just trying not to burn any more bridges, you know? I feel like everywhere I go, there's just matches strewn all over the pavement.
Sounds like there are some stories here, but... Your polite laughter makes me think maybe I shouldn't ask follow-up questions. Okay, so let's go back then to... We were talking about first impressions of the scene in London. Do you remember the very first place that you ever went to?
The first queer place that I went to... We wouldn't have called it queer back then, so I don't know why I'm saying it now. We would have called it gay. because lesbians weren't a thing. They didn't exist to us. We just wanted to meet other gay men. And it took a long time for me to meet some lesbians on level terms. That was one of the things about the scene in the late 90s, you know. And I'm not sure that it's much better now, but I think it is more inclusive now. I think there is much more chance to hang out with queer women and not just all, you know, go to the bar, which is exclusively for men. So the first place... I don't remember what it was called, but in Leicester Square, there was this really thin, dark, winding staircase just to the side of some shopfront, which would have changed from restaurant to restaurant over the years. And there was this old gay guy, I think he was quite short and bald, and he said, I'd never been in there before, I was with one other friend. And we went up to the bar, smiling. And he went, all right, cunt, what do you want? And I was like, oh, okay, this is a brand new world. But there was no hatred in that C word, none at all. It was all theatrics and love. And I understood it. I understood that attitude. I don't know why I understood that attitude, but I did. And everything about the place just came with, you know, a little wink and a nudge, and it was tremendously inappropriate. And the staff and the other punters would, you know, grope you lightly, you know, not dreadfully. I mean, I wasn't bothered. I was very happy to be touched by anybody in my 20s. Not anybody, but you know, most people would get a look in if I gave them the chance. And it just felt like you'd joined a club. And the drinks were really, really cheap, which was the best part about it all. So if you could get up the stairs and crucially get back down them after you'd been drinking for 7 hours, then it was a great place to hang. I wish I could remember what it was called.
Oh, but so you went there with a friend.
Yeah.
Do you remember like the feeling of anticipation?
I'd been in London a good, you know, we'd been there for a good couple of terms, really, and just stuck to local pubs in Wood Green. And there weren't any other gay people in my... That's not true. There were a handful of gay people in my year at drama school, but really just two or three of us. I think another joined later on in the term. But we'd never sort of like, right, come on, boys, we're all off to GAY. Mm. We never really pulled ourselves together and did anything. I mean, we were terribly poor. I mean, the idea of going into the West End, you know, just to go to a bar was not something we could do lightly as drama school students. It was astronomically expensive undertaking for most of us. We're talking in 1994, the fees for 3 years of drama school was £18,000. £1,000. Just the fees. So, and I wasn't from a rich family, as I've already said. So, yeah, I guess it took a long while before we were both brave and solvent enough to get into town and see the clubs and the bars, really. Which is why I guess I ended up working in them before I had time to properly enjoy them, in inverted commas.
Oh. But, okay, so we're here to talk about Madame Jojo's. I know we're quite far into the conversation, probably should have brought it up by now.
Yeah.
Were you working at Madame Jojo's, or how does that come into the picture?
Yeah, I was. I was actually working as a waitress in a cocktail bar. It's true, I was, it's true.
I think the line is, that much is true, not it's
true. Yeah, that much is totally accurate. No, it's kind of true. So I was working, like all good, you know, people that have just been thrown out of drama school. I didn't graduate, I was thrown out of drama school.
Very quickly, why?
Money.
Oh, okay. Oh, so you didn't, like, defecate in the...
I didn't bugger the bursar or anything. Okay, all right. I wish I had. I was 3 months away from graduation.
Couldn't
or wouldn't support my getting to the finish line, so I went. And so I was waiting, which is a skill that I had as a child because my mother was a caterer. So I've been working weddings since I was about 12. So, you know, looking after 10 tables in a busy restaurant on Old Compton Street, which is, for those people that don't know, the gayest street in London, in the West End. If you're gay and you come to London, the first place you go is Old Compton Street. Rightly or wrongly, that's the rules. And there was a lovely restaurant. It's part of a chain, but nevertheless, it was very nice. It was called The Dome. And I was a good waiter then. I'm sure I'd be a good one if I did it again now. I make good tips. I'm very charming and I can hold a lot of plates. And there was a period where I'd started to even work there in drag because they found out that I did drag. And so I'd even stood there, you know, greeting people and working as a waitress in a cocktail bar, ultimately. But I was working in my civvies one day. I'd been thrown out of drama school and my career was in the toilet before it had begun. And two drag queens from Madame Jojo's came in for lunch. They weren't in drag, but you talk to your customers because you want to make tips. And so I learnt about them and got very, very excited. And I told them that I'd just been to drama school and that I loved drag. I'd never done drag in my... that's not true. I'd done Rocky Horror twice for fancy dress when I was a kid. But I hadn't ever done anything else. And
Wait, when you did it as a kid, was this before you realised you were gay or after?
Before.
Okay, before. Interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, right. Consciously and subconsciously are words I use a lot in my life and have done for many years. So anyway, they were very friendly. Juana La Cubana from Trinidad and Tobago was at the table, and I don't remember the other person's name because I didn't end up dating them. But they were friendly too. But they said, well, look, there's auditions. We're looking for new showgirls and you should come. We'll get you an audition. And they did. They got me an audition and I got the job. And I became a showgirls at Madame Jojo's world famous cabaret club. I'd never even been there.
Wait, and so you hadn't really properly done drag at this stage?
No, not really. No.
So how did you prepare your audition? What did you do?
I just sang. I sang a song a cappella, probably the same one I sang to get into drama school. And then they would have taught us a little dance routine. There would have been a little bit of a dance call. But I'd just come from 3 years of jazz lessons at a top musical theatre school with one of the best dance teachers that 90s ever saw.
Yeah, but they didn't teach you in high heels.
No, they didn't teach me in high heels. That's true. That is very true. I took to heels like a duck to water.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was very obvious to me. Very, very
fascinating.
I liked that a lot. I must have worn my mum's shoes. I mean, my mother didn't really wear makeup, so there wasn't a big makeup bag to play with, and she didn't have, like, endless heels. But I'm sure she must have had a shoe with a heel on it, and I must have tried it on. So this idea of having never done drag, I mean, I'm sure there was a pop on a petticoat and put a scarf around your head and twirl around the front room, I'm sure.
Yeah, but there's a difference between doing that and, like, actually looking acceptable, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that I know I did a lot of twirling in a lot of things that didn't belong to me when I was a child.
few Kate Bush moments, yeah. Okay, so you got this job.
I did. I got the job. And in the 90s, I think I'm right in saying that it was quite rare, very, very, very common now, but very rare to find a drag queen on the London scene that had musical theatre training. We did tend for the most part, to be live singers. There wasn't a lot of lip syncing around in the 90s. Actually, very little indeed, as far as I can remember. When it sort of appeared all over again in later years, so we'd be like, what? We're not even singing! Get off the stage! There's always been a little bit, what is that? Is that an art form? It's totally an art form. I mean, I have met some world-class and worked with some world-class lip syncers, but it is a very, very easy job to phone in. You can fudge it easily if you look fantastic. But, you know, looking fantastic and being a lip syncer are not actually the same thing. Anyway, hate mail aside, I got the job and I was in a small cast. The show had been decimated a bit by a change in management. So what had been a very lavish period in JoJo's history had sort of stopped, and we were given a gold slash curtain and four of us, to make the best of it. And so I was taken under the wing of the two girls who were already there, me and this new girl, Penny. Her name was Penny Century and mine was Trinity Million. and the girls that gave us the job and that did the choreography and were the stars, and we had to stand behind them, and didn't get a solo. They were called Kitty Cartier and Crystal Wade. And Kitty taught me how to do drag makeup. Crystal taught me how to drink all afternoon and still get on stage and do a show afterwards, which I'm very grateful
important
to.
Skills.
Yeah. Am I? But I'm very grateful to Crystal for introducing me to the movie Auntie Mame. I mean, you will be forever in my debt because of Rosalind Russell and Auntie Mame. The five green cocktails you mixed me, maybe not so much those. And they were my mamas. They were. We didn't say that. We didn't say drag mother. I'd never heard that term until I saw Pose and Drag Race in the last 5-6 years. I was like, what are you talking about? And people think that was my life too, and it wasn't. I didn't have that vocabulary, and I didn't have that relationship with Kitty and Crystal. I saw them at work, almost exclusively at work, apart from this one time when Crystal got us drunk, and that was it, my hand was not held outside of work, and I was not nurtured and cared for by them or anyone else. It was just made left to get on with it.
So do you remember, the first performance you ever did at Madame JoJo's?
Oh, my God. I will never forget the first performance I did at Madame JoJo's. We were doing Proud Mary, Tina Turner. And as I say, I was at the back of the stage. And it was a very small stage. It was a triangle-shaped, and all four of us were in the Proud Mary number. They'd given us gorgeous costumes that are absolutely stunning. Gold, strappy heels, gold bikini top and thong, but metallic gold with bits on, everything you wanted from a drag outfit, and massive headdress. I was all black, short Liza, it was a feathery black Liza close to the head wig, with a hamburger underneath just to give it some height, that sort of a job. And then they gave us these massive, stiff tulle gold feather boas. They weren't feather, they were tulle. And we had to do this dance routine to Proud Mary, which went something like this. It was sort of like, big wheel, keep on turning. And then you had to do a crossover for Proud Mary. And you had to turn around after you'd done that thing with your arms. Now, when you do that with a very stiff tulle boa and a gold slash curtain behind you, you end up wrapped up in the slash curtain. And that was pinned to the wall like a mummy. And I had to do the second verse just wrapped up in a curtain. And the other thing that nobody tells you when you start doing drag is, if you're going to wear clip-on earrings and dance, you need to glue them to your ears. So before that had even happened to me, both my earrings had pinged off and flown into the audience and hit people. So I lost my brand new earrings, fucked up my first night, and the rest is history.
But despite that, it was a good show.
It was amazing. I loved it. I remember standing behind the curtain, and I think Kitty and was doing the solo, or Kitty and Crystal were there together. But it was busy. The backstage area was just as small as the stage, and we were flinging boas and corsets around the place. And everywhere you turned, there was a cigarette in an ashtray. You could still smoke indoors. It was always overflowing ashtray, overflowing with ash and glitter. It was just a strange mixture that in every room you went into. Fucking amazing. I loved it. It was like the most glamorous thing ever. And I remember just stopping for a moment backstage in between, you know, flinging all of these costumes, just letting it all hang there for a moment and thinking, I've arrived. And about 4 months later, standing in exactly the same place at the same point in the show, thinking, get me out of here.
Ooh, okay, so that was going to be my follow-up question. Like, how long were you performing there? Was that moment of realization the catalyst for you to leave, or did you stay for a number of years hating it?
No, I stayed 6 months. So, and around month four, I knew I couldn't stay for very long. Yeah.
And why was that?
Well, you don't get treated very well as a drag queen. You certainly didn't in the late 90s. I don't think you do now, really. I think that, you know, whether it's drag or being a pantomime dame, which is a massive part of our industry here in the UK, there is such a huge lack of understanding of the job. And of what it entails and of the skill involved. I mean, yeah, you've already alluded to the heels. So, yeah, imagine doing whatever the show is. And with pantomime, a lot of people don't know this outside of the UK, but our pantomime season in December through to January, you know, dark, hard months, you do two shows a day. And sometimes you do three shows a day and you get Christmas Day off. And that's it. You get Christmas Day off. For some contracts, that's all you'll get. For 8 weeks, sometimes the contract can be as long as 8 weeks. That is very, very grueling. And if you are a dame or an ugly sister, you'll have 7 to 10 costume changes. And because the pantomime dame is never really a famous person, because that job gets given to somebody else, the role, you know, the role of Captain Hook is the star, or Cinderella is the star, you know. It's very seldom that the dame is a star. Seldom, not rare. So you don't ever get the dressing room next to the stage. So some dick who was on television 20 years ago who doesn't have any costume changes is sitting on a sofa doing nothing for 3 hours. And you are, and I'm not exaggerating, you are ploughing up and down three sets of concrete steps in bell-shaped dresses, tilting them sideways and trying not to knock your headdress off to get changed sometimes up to 9 times per show. And they still won't give you the dressing room next to the stage. I know that's not drag, it's panto, but it's the same thing, you know. It's a lack of understanding of what the job entails. If you wanted somebody to rewire your house, you'd have to give them access to the certain things that they needed and turn off the electricity and give them a certain amount of time to do it. I remember there was a pantomime contract I had once, and pantomime contracts always come with schools shows in the daytime, and they're awful because the children just scream for 2 hours and throw popcorn at you. It's just horrible. And you just stand there thinking that your soul has died. And this particular theatre, school shows started at 10 a.m. for the first 2 weeks of the run, but they refused to open the theatre before 9 a.m. any morning. And they expected me to be ready to be the pantomime dame with all said costume changes and to join in with a mandatory physical and vocal warm-up every single day and still put on the full face. And I don't think people understand how much of you is glued together. You know, it's not just the earrings. You know, there's a pin holding up those gloves to that dress, and there's another pin there, there's another. And everywhere you turn, there's something tucked, something pinned, something glued. There's very little of you actually breathing. Your skin hasn't got any air. And this is drag too, you know. You've got the layers and layers of makeup, sometimes because you're running around a lot, sometimes because weather like this, your makeup would literally fall on the floor immediately afterwards. So there's a lot going on and it isn't comfortable. And one of the reasons I actually left JoJo's was because one night the air conditioning failed and they'd taken too many members of the public in. It was illegal, it was overcrowded. And our job when we weren't on stage was to mingle and help sell drinks and be charming to people. And I said, I'm not going out there. And we had a big old fight. They say they fired me, I say I resigned, and no one will ever know the truth except me. and you, because you know. I resigned. I'm not doing that.
Okay, so in a hark back to our earlier conversation, I was going to ask whether you took the bridge-burning approach to leaving.
Which is why that's not the only story where I think I resigned and they think they fired me, because, yes, there's always an explosion of some kind. I can think of at least two other instances in my life where we're both saying that we're in the right there. Because first there's an explosion and I lose it. Yeah. Mm. Because I can't believe that you've been so disrespectful. That it's so baffling to me that you would do that to a person. But they actually just haven't thought about what they're doing and what they're asking.
Yes. So it sounds like you're a bit like me, like this really strong sense of injustice and then just bottling it up and then getting to a point where you're just like, no!
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely right. And I keep standing up and speaking out and then looking around and going, oh, there's no one else. We were all just saying the same thing in the other room, you know?
It's been
my whole life has been like that. So that's why I find it hard to be, you know, members of families, because that's bogus and you're all out for yourselves, I'm afraid.
So you left in this like cloud of disappointment and pissed offedness. That's a word, I've just made it up.
I did, yeah.
So why is it that you wanted to talk about Madame Jojo's today?
Because I never stopped going back to Jojo's as a compere, hosting other shows, you know, as well as the in-house drag show. As years went by, the drag got diluted at Madame Jojo's from 1986, when it first became a drag club. It was a club from around the 60s, but in 86, Paul Raymond, the famous porn baron of Soho, turned it into a drag show specifically. And until 2000 and, I want to say 14.
16?
16, yeah, that sounds right.
No, 14, you're right. At some point.
Yeah, somewhere around there, the place closed down altogether. But there was a period when sort of the drag became diluted. After our show, it would turn into a school disco, you know, and everybody has to just turn up in like shirt and tie and shorts, and even though they're 30, you know. I don't know how people would feel about that right now. Would they say that was appropriation of children or childhood or something? I don't know.
Yeah, because it doesn't really happen anymore, does it? Those kind of school disco nights.
I think somebody would find a way of finding that inappropriate, I'm sure. So I have, since having left JoJo's as a drag performer, I've been back in and out of drag for other promoters. And the management changed a long time ago at JoJo's. And my issue was with the management and the way that I was being treated, never with the club, which I have always loved. And I'm very, very proud to be a JoJo's girl, and for Trinity Millian's name to be linked to all of those other iconic girls there. But it was a hard place to work, and it was barely all glamour, really. I think the most important thing about JoJo's was the in-house drag show aside, it was a place like many others up until the mid 2010s, where, yes, you did want to give the audience a considered, polished, rehearsed, professional show, but that didn't mean that you couldn't be anarchic. You couldn't try out new things. You couldn't be, you know, a bit in your face and antagonistic about things. And I think that's what I always have been drawn to cabaret for. You know, if you go back to 1881, to Le Chat Noir, the very first cabaret club in the history of cabarets.
Oh, yeah, I remember that club, yeah.
You remember? Yeah, I saw you there on a Thursday, usually. Yeah. Well, you remember when we used to go there on the Thursday, people would get up and they would dissent against the popular view. It was a place to be heard. It was Twitter. It was X, you know. And to dissent. And dissent is, people don't know this about cabaret, most people. They think that cabaret is something to talk over, or it means that the performer will wander through the audience with a feather boa at some point. And I'm not saying that either of those assumptions are wrong, but it also, perhaps most importantly, was and should be a place of enormous dissent and a way to stand up to power and speak truth to power, as Brené Brown would have it.
So with that in mind then, what did Madame Jojo's teach you about yourself?
Well, I think Madame Jojo's is where I I can remember first being celebrated properly, and my queerness, and Trin, being Trin, and doing that there was freeing. I don't know why I'm thinking about an image of running through a field and just freedom, just, oh, like I said, you know, I really meant it when I stood behind that curtain and went, I've arrived. I wanted velvet curtains. I wanted brass poles. I wanted glamour. I wanted glitter in an ashtray. I wanted all of the Asian drag queens / trannies in the back room who you could only go in to see if you bought a bottle of champagne at least. And then we move on from there. Whatever might happen back there, how would I know what happened back there? Okay, I don't know what happened back there, except I had to walk through to get to my dressing room every single night. I wanted all of that. I wanted applause, I wanted to be hit on by strangers, and I wanted to be told I was fabulous and glamorous and had brilliant legs and that people were jealous of my jawline and couldn't believe I was a boy. And JoJo's gave me all of that and a whole bunch of nutcases like me to hang out with.
Do you have any memories of Madame JoJo's, or maybe clubbing from your own queer scene that you want to share? Well, if you do, why not get in touch? I want to create the biggest online record of people's memories and stories of queer clubbing, but I cannot do it alone. I need your help. Go to lostspacespodcast.com, find the section Share a Lost Space, and then tell me all about what it is you got up to. You can also reach out to me on Facebook and Instagram, where my handle is Lost Spaces Pod, and I'd love to chat with you there. Find out more about Paulus by visiting his website, thecabaretgeek.com, or following him on Facebook or Instagram, where his handle is thecabaretgeek. If you enjoyed this episode, I would really appreciate if you took the time to subscribe, leave a review on your podcast platform of choice, or just tell other people who you think might enjoy listening to me ramble on with someone for between 30 minutes and 45 minutes. My name's Kay Anderson, and you have been listening to Lost Spaces.